We're talking about Howard Hughes tonight. I posted some photos last night on coasttocoastam.com about the secret life of Howard Hughes. And I said last night, we think of him as a secretive person, and anybody who's seen any of the biographies, you know, The Aviator or any of the other movies about Howard Hughes, you kind of feel like at least you get a feel for his life and death. We're going to challenge that tonight. If you think the story for sure, the undisputable story is that Howard Hughes died on a private jet, being ferried between a hotel in Mexico and a hospital in Houston, you could end up being right. But you ought to consider the alternative before you do. And that's where Mark Music comes into that next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. Well, Mark Music, before we get started with the story, let's find out a little bit more about your story, because I've struggled getting your exact titling right, because you've had several different ranks. So I know that it's tradition that I should refer to you as your highest attained title, highest earned title. So would that not be when you retired, you were a major general in the Air Force?
Ian, that's right. I was a major general in the Air Force.
Okay.
But I'd just be like it if you just call me Mark.
That I promise you I will. But out of respect, and because it's kind of a cool part of who you are and adds credibility, I think, to the story, let me back that up then. So you retired as a major general in 2008. Prior to that, you were the assistant adjutant general, and you worked for the U.S. Strategic Air Command. Is that right?
Yes. My position with U.S. Strategic Air Command was the mobilization assistant to the deputy commander.
Okay.
And that was my last position, which was about 4 years, from 2004 to 2008.
And you kind of got there by being in charge of the unit that did in-flight refueling?
I was a commander for Nebraska Air Guard prior to that, and then chief of staff for Nebraska Air Guard in there also.
Okay. Pretty cool. You know, mazel tov on what a great military career. And did you ever, when you retired, set off to say, I think I'm going to write books?
No. That just kind of came to me as this story came to me that we're going to talk about tonight. I was too excited about Howard Hughes, actually, until I was told this story and then started researching it and found out there's a lot more to Howard Hughes than what the public's been told.
So I'm counting on that, by the way, and it's very interesting. I'm at one disadvantage that I almost never have on this show is that I usually have about 2 weeks' notice before a booking, and I actually read the material and I get a lot more to work with, and then I sort of sift through it and I go through it and I look for the things which look great on paper or fit perfectly when you're reading a narrative, but may be confusing if you're trying to tell a narrative. So I can't do that with you because we booked you kind of at the last minute. I'm very excited about this, but I sort of missed that opportunity to do that kind of narrative work with what you're going to say. So bear with me as I sort this through a little bit more roughly than I usually do on Coast to Coast, but I couldn't pass it up because I am very fascinated by Howard Hughes, and I have read previous biographies. I loved that movie that was so popular, the Melvin and Howard movie, the Jonathan Demme movie. I've seen several of the biographies for him on A&E. I think he's a very interesting guy who is interesting kind of in four different stages of his life. And so he's, you know, as a businessman, and then as a movie mogul, and then as this recluse, and then how he sadly kind of dies. All of those acts kind of portray Howard Hughes differently. If you tuned into one act, you might never have anticipated what he'd be like in act three or act four. Do you know what I mean?
Oh, you're exactly correct. The guy was a genius, and he had so many different things going on throughout his life. He made movies. He had the aerospace business. He loved aviation. He had so many different things going on in his life, but his overall personality was reclusive.
Right.
He really didn't like the public viewing him. He really didn't like being out there. And that kind of reflected in a lot of his later part of his life.
Well, and I think too, he had demons that he did a great job shielding from public view, as you say. But because of that, because of the reclusivity, you know, I don't know if you're familiar with this term that they use in recovery, that you're only as sick as your secrets. And he had a lot of secrets. And I think that's the overall sickness that killed Howard Hughes, was being so secretive. And you just get into that sort of downward shame spirals, which ended up creating all of these problems for him later in life. So that's why it's interesting that you, and I'm just going to guess here, but living a fairly public military life where you've got a file and people review what you do and you have to go and, you know, you get bumped up on the basis of performance and all that you're a pretty well vetted guy, and you couldn't have done as well as you did within the military and have the kind of secrets that Howard Hughes was hiding. So there's a guy I would look at and say, probably a little bit more transparent than the rest of us have to be in order to be successful, writing a book about a guy who is hardly transparent, who is almost like the kind of the direct opposite of you. Maybe if you're in his own sort of way, he was very flamboyant, but he also just had all of these dark shadows that you're trying to peer into.
For putting the story together was kind of like a big jigsaw puzzle, where you find these little pieces, these little bits and pieces, and the story begins to appear, but there's still many, many pieces that are still hidden away, and they just come a little bit at a time from different sources.
Right.
But it yields this big picture of Howard, who was a very, very intelligent, very, very secretive
man. Yeah,
he was.
So, again, we're talking with Mark Musick, who's the co-author of soon to be a major motion picture, I think. It was it's what it's shaping up like. Boxes, The Secret Life of Howard Hughes. So you retire. You decide that you are going to work with some nonprofits in your retirement. Was that just kind of a keep it busy kind of thing, or were you, did you have a goal to continue to work in that community, you know, 40 hours a week all along?
No, I had worked in various locations, and I worked in this nonprofit. And in doing that, I met this lady, name of Eva McClelland, and talked to her over the phone several times. And I knew there was some strangeness in there with her and the way she lived. And I knew her husband had died in November of 2001. And I was in Georgia, so I went and met her in 2002. This was January 2002. And she said, "Mark, there's something that I want to tell you." And I said, "Well, Eva, what is that?" And she said, "I was married to Howard Hughes." And I knew her husband had just died about 2 months earlier. And I said, Eva, Howard Hughes died 25 years ago. And she said, "That's what they want you to think." And this led into this whole huge story and research project and investigation and going and trying to determine, was this the truth or not? And I just didn't believe it for about 4 years. I just thought she was crazy.
And for good reason, too, because it goes so counter to the narrative and to accepted what would seemingly be a verifiable historical fact. But I want to put a pin in "they," and I want to come back to that later on. But why was it that you were ended up talking with this woman, Eva McClelland? You were in Lincoln, Nebraska, doing a not-for-profit. She's in Dothan, Alabama. How are you talking on the phone over what?
She called up the organization and wanted to leave the organization in her will.
And why would she do that sort of randomly?
She liked what the organization was doing.
Okay.
And so she liked what the organization was doing, wanted to leave it in her will, and I I then became in contact with her. And she knew I had a military background, which I think she kind of liked. So she knew I had a military background. In fact, she asked me one time to help her with the VA in Montgomery, Alabama, to get a ramp built up to their trailer in the woods. And I made contact into the Montgomery, Alabama VA, and the ramp got built. And so I think she felt that I helped them in that way. And then she felt more comfortable with me when I actually met her in person.
Okay. So you fly to, you're in Georgia, Dothan, Alabama is a short drive. You go over there and you meet with her in person, and she confesses that she was married to Howard Hughes. And where was she? So living in a trailer in the woods, in like a double wide kind of a situation?
They had, this is what's really unusual. They had a property about 12 acres of wooded property west of Troy, Alabama. It's about 10 miles west of Troy, Alabama. And that's what they own. That's where they live for about since 2011 to 2001. And they had moved there. He wasn't able to stay there any longer. They'd moved into an apartment in Dothan, Alabama. So she was actually living in Dothan, Alabama at that point in time. But they had lived west of Troy, Alabama from about 1974 until about 2000.
Okay. Now this is the part. Yeah. So this is the part where it gets a little tricky, right? Because if Howard Hughes, in the accepted narrative, dies in 1976, and he'd been flying around to a couple of different places, he had a couple of different locations where he had lived, but he was being, you know, transported like a Shah. He would, or like a holy man or something, because he didn't, his appearance was awful. According to a couple of things I read, his body odor was distinct. Right? Emphasis on the stinked part of distinct. And that he was this eccentric figure, and that it wasn't like people didn't notice where he was or know where he was, because when somebody is that famous, somebody has that much money, and physically their presence makes them pretty easy to find in the dark, that there seemed to be no dispute about where Howard Hughes was between 1974 and 1976, the period between when it's claimed that he had gone to be with Eva McClellan and the period when publicly it was announced that he had died. Do I have that right?
Okay, the mystery here becomes, there's two men. There's two men. You have the long-haired, long-fingernail, drug-addicted, bedridden guy with the horrible breath and the rotted teeth. That's one man. And you have Howard Hughes, a commanding, charming man in charge of his business. That's another man. So the long-haired, long-fingernail, drug-addicted guy was introduced into the picture about 1969. And he was the one who was transported from Las Vegas to the Bahamas to Nicaragua.
Right, to Mexico,
to
back
Canada,
to Houston.
And so forth.
Right. Yeah.
And Howard, the real Howard, was living with Eva McClelland, traveling where they would travel. They lived in Panama for about 2 years, then they moved to Arizona for a couple of years, then they moved to Alabama for a couple of years, for the rest of their lives, basically, but moved to four or five different locations in Alabama during that time frame. So there's two men thrown in here, so you have maximum confusion of what is really happening here.
Okay. So in a lot of ways, the narrative that you are suggesting, that the fully in command of his own facilities business mogul continues on happily ever after, outside of the public spotlight, married to Eva McClellan, being slightly vagabondish, but not being nothing out of the nothing unusual, nothing that eccentric, that narrative actually fits pretty nicely with the famous Latter-day Saints will and the story that's behind that, which was the basis of the movie Melvin and Howard, that the real Howard Hughes was still an active guy who was having fun, enjoying life, out riding motorcycles, driving cars. He had a road mishap. He gets picked up by this guy who is a mechanic. The mechanic drives him to the Sands Hotel, drops him off there, doesn't think twice about it until suddenly a will shows up that's dropped on his desk. And that will is what ends up with the Church of Latter-day Saints. And that they say this is the legitimate will of Howard Hughes when he dies. The courts rule against them eventually, but it would have made Melvin of Melvin and Howard very wealthy, like $150 million or something. And it would have been with the church, would have been divided up, but there was an actual will. And that seemingly makes sense because this alternative version of Howard Hughes, where he was basically mentally incapacitated on drugs and in this horrible, almost not vegetative, but in a state which seemed to be disassociative, that narrative doesn't fit with a guy who would have been out riding motorcycles. And it doesn't fit that somewhere along the line, it doesn't even fit with Howard Hughes if he's a businessman of any acumen, that he never left a will. That doesn't even make sense.
Boy, you're exactly right. That Melvin Dumars episode happened in 1967, December 1967. And we think that's absolutely true. Everything he had there, Melvin Dumars did pick up Howard in 1967. Because what we learned is that Howard, even though the aide said he never left the hotel in Las Vegas, he would put on disguises. He'd wear wigs. He'd put on disguises. And he would leave the hotel. He'd actually go into his hotels and do some gambling, but he wanted to make sure that no one would recognize him.
So
and then this long-haired, long-fingernailed gentleman that we found out about him, he was actually a friend of Howard's who was 20 years older than Howard.
Okay.
So all the books say when they talk about this long-haired, long-fingernailed guy, you know, he fell in a hotel in 73 in London. And the doctor said, well, he looks like he's 20 years older than Howard should look. Well, he looked like he's 20 years older because he was 20 years older, and he was a drug addict, and he was just acting, standing in for Howard during that time until he actually passed of natural causes in 1976.
Okay, here we go. So I'm going to ask you a series of questions. Okay? But we're not going to answer them because we're coming up to the bottom of the hour. I just want to know, I want you to tell me what cards are you holding on this, okay? Do we know the name, the actual birth name and the biography of the long-haired, broken-toothed, rotting-mouth, long-fingernailed guy, which becomes the dominant narrative of the Howard Hughes story at the end? Do we know his name, his background?
We do not totally know his name. No.
Okay, wait. Okay, fine.
Totally know his name.
So, no, we don't know. I'm going to ask you some other questions. We'll get back to all these. We'll unpack these as we go along. I'm just getting ready for the bottom of the hour. Do we know how that the two of them, how supposedly how Howard Hughes would have recruited this guy to be his double or to take over, or to assume his life while he pursued other interests? Do we know that story?
What I have learned, what I've been told, is that this gentleman was an acquaintance of Howard's.
Okay, stop right there. We'll get back to that. Okay, do we know whether any autopsy information available about Howard Hughes is inconsistent with the findings of the body as it was examined after his death on his way from Mexico to Houston? Don't answer that question. That's what we'll hang on to. We'll get to all of these. So you're getting the idea. Mark Music has a story to tell. came from a woman named Eva McClellan, who said, I was married to the real Howard Hughes. That other guy was a fake. And we'll get to that real story next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. Well, I'm just loving this story, but then again, I always love alternative history on Coast to Coast AM. And in this case, this is something that's going to charge, I think it's going to point the finger at a lot of different organizations for being compliant or complicit with something, which, or both, that they did in their own best interests. The idea, for example, that they invalidated the famous LDS will of Howard Hughes so that it went to court, right? It had to be settled intestate. Is that what they call it? Intestate. So it was going to have to get sorted out by a judge who then divided it up amongst a couple dozen different organizations, as opposed to the way that it looked like it was going to go. And how did a businessman as big as Howard Hughes never have a will? I don't know. Anyway, the entertaining part here that we'll get to in just a second is, so who was the guy? Who was the quote-unquote body double of Howard Hughes, which we most commonly and sort of mockingly associate with the end of this famously successful businessman, pioneer, aviator, a producer of movies, a ladies' man. I mean, a guy who just had so much going for him. How everybody used to wonder, like, how did he end up as this shriveled mess at the end of his life? Well, what if he didn't? What if it was just a clever ruse? That's what Mark Music is going to tell us about next. How did it happen on Coast to Coast AM? This is Ian Punnett. All right, let's roll back the story a little bit with Mark Music, retired Nebraska Air National Guard Major General and the co-author of this work, which I didn't have a chance to read, but I do love the photos that we got from you, and we posted them at coasttocoastam.com. Boxes, The Secret Life of Howard Hughes. So let's go back a little bit. Let's go back to the early 60s. What was Howard Hughes like in the early 1960s? What was the trajectory of his life? Before we get into the Melvin and Howard era and, you know, before the downward spiral, what was his life like?
Well, in the early 1960s, Howard had already pulled back from public view. He was married to a lady named Jean Peters, a movie star.
Right.
And he was pretty much just handling his businesses at that point in time. He was involved with a lot of different businesses, in aviation, in space, and things like that. And so he was just pretty much handling his businesses. But he had had an aircraft accident in 1946 and was still had some damage from that. His hands were damaged, his feet were damaged, and things like that. So he had a lot of experiences there. We also know in the early 60s that he would bring people in who looked like him, who would be a stand-in.
So that already started in the 1960s.
Yeah, there's one particular guy named Brooks Randall who was a movie star in the movies, and he looked like Howard. And Howard had actually sent him into meetings and things like that. So this having this idea of having someone, you know, take your place, that started very early. And then this long-haired, long fingernail guy comes into the picture.
You're jumping ahead. So the reason I say that is because that's a really good way of setting the table, because it wasn't just the long-haired finger. We're talking about he was already establishing. He didn't want to go to see some board meeting at Hughes, you know, Tool and Die or Hughes Manufacturing. He didn't want to do that. So he would send somebody else in who might just sit there, nod along, not say anything, hold the program, wave, whatever, walk out. And that was already part of what his pattern was developing. He was already seeing that as a successful play and that people didn't question it.
That seemed to be the case exactly, because there'd be meetings and there'd be someone who would say, well, look, there's Howard Hughes in the back of the room. And he would never say anything, but he'd just turn around and leave.
Right.
And that was his stand-in that actually looked like Howard.
Love that. So then, but as far as we know, he and Jean Peters, were they happily married up to that point?
They got married in 1957, and I think they were fairly happily married. The interesting thing about this, from 1966 on, no book says that they ever saw each other.
They stopped seeing each other in 1966.
So they're divorced in 1971. They never were face to face.
And there's no photographs of them appearing somewhere for a film festival or something where Jean Peters might be, he's not on her arm. There's nothing. They just stop being seen publicly together.
Right. In fact, Howard didn't want his photograph taken. The last photograph of Howard was about 1952 or 53, I think. And that was the last official photograph of Howard taken then. And there's only one other photograph I saw of Howard, which is just kind of an incidental photograph of him in the later 50s. But he never wanted his picture taken.
Okay. So, and at a time when, you know, before people had cameras on every phone where you could, whether you like it or not, somebody could, or before there was a lot of video cameras for security, you could reasonably go through a period of time and not have your picture taken if that's what you wanted. So then comes 1966. He stops seeing his wife. They no longer are in contact with each other. Starts 1967. That's the time when Howard Hughes is associated with this guy, Melvin Dumars, the mechanic who bails him out after he was having some fun out in the desert, but mechanical problems, and he drives him back into the Sands Hotel and eventually gets a copy of the will. Okay. What happens? When does he meet? Now let's go. When does he meet the guy who you say is the guy who starts standing in for Howard, the long-haired, long-fingernailed guy? When does that happen?
Okay, there's several things that happened in 68 and 69.
Okay.
In 1968, there was a Soviet submarine that sank northwest of Hawaii. In 1969, the CIA goes to Howard and says, will you raise that submarine? And he said, yes, I will raise it. And he did in 1974, went and raised a submarine. That same time, this is speculation on our part, but that same time is when he shows up now under this other identity of a man who was a CIA operative who just disappeared. And so, and that's about the same time.
You lost me a little bit. Who's the CIA operative? What do you mean he shows up? Howard Hughes becomes a CIA operative?
Howard Hughes takes on the identity of a CIA operative who disappeared.
And he takes, so does he take this guy's name? Is that you're saying? Is that there's an identity that was given for him? He assumed this identity so that he could work on the submarine. And then that person with that identity that's associated with the CIA just kind of vanishes.
The person associated, there's a man named Werner Nicely, and we've got all of his military records and traced them back.
Okay.
And he was in the military during World War II, left the Air Force in the mid-50s and went to work for the CIA. And he was living in Panama, and he disappeared. We don't know what happened to him, but he disappeared. He was 5'11", gray eyes and so forth, smart guy. And now here comes a 6'4" man who has assumed the identity of that man. And that's who Eva McClellan meets.
Okay. This is good. So how does Eva McClellan meet this guy, which is actually Howard Hughes, who had assumed the identity of a real CIA operative during this time when we might just assume he's worked out some sort of quid pro quo with the CIA to take over this guy's identity?
Yes, and how this fits is Eva McClellan was in Panama,
okay,
Howard Air Force Base, working at a job there, and this is now November of 69. She sees this tall, handsome man who's got AIDS around him, and they get to visiting. she's working there in a position, civil service position, and a very responsible civil service position. And now this tall guy shows up in Panama, Howard Air Force Base. They get to interacting with each other, and they enjoy each other. She resembles a little bit of Elizabeth Taylor.
Mm.
And Howard Hughes, of course, loved Elizabeth Taylor. And she resembles her. So that they now are talking. And then in December 69, January 70, he disappears. He's gone from Panama. He comes back now in Panama in February of 70. And Eva asks him, they get back together again. Eva asks him, where have you been? And he said, well, I had some business to attend to in the States. Now, he says his name is Nick Nicolay.
Oh, wait, wait, wait.
He has an identification of a man named Werner Nicely, but he says his name is Nick Nicolay.
That's the name he says to Eva McClellan, the woman he would eventually marry.
Yes.
He says, my real name is Nick Nicolay, but I've been assuming the name of this other guy, but my real name is Nick.
He didn't say that. She didn't know the real story until several years later.
I see.
They were engaged in March of 70. They're now engaged in March of 70. And he says, I need you to sign my name. But it's not Nick Nicolay that she signs. It's Werner Nicely that she signs. And so she practices Werner Nicely. And she then signs Werner Nicely for the next 31 years. He never signs anything.
Okay, and this is presumably, he's saying, let's sign a marriage certificate, let's get going, but he hasn't yet officially divorced Jean Peters yet.
Correct.
Okay, so he's got that business to attend to, too.
Correct. That's exactly correct.
Okay, so now just, again, now let's hold for a second. So then what about the guy? What about the long-haired guy? Has he come into the picture yet, the long-haired, long-fingernailed guy that smells bad?
What seemed to happen was when Howard took this other identity given to him by the CIA, that's when this guy comes in, the long-haired, long-fingernail guy, comes in the picture. Because that way Howard could travel where he wanted to travel, and they could take this long-haired, long-fingernail guy, being Howard Hughes, and kind of move him to where they wanted to move him to create a lot of mystery around him.
So sort of a slight, so a little bit of a sleight of hand that they bring.
Yeah.
They're both on the same plane, for example, but Howard still dressed like Howard and still looks like, still now going by a different name. But this guy is the guy that's saying, oh, look, there's Mr. Hughes. And they get everybody looking at this kind of, you know, squirrely old guy. And everybody's going, look at, oh, Howard's really let himself go. So they get everybody focused on that.
They would even set meetings up. They'd say, okay, Ian, you're going to meet Howard Hughes. And you go in and meet this guy, and they say, well, what was he like? He said, well, he had long hair and long fingernails, and his breath was horrible, and his teeth were rotted, and he looked like he weighed 100 pounds. And they said, well, that was Howard.
And part of that,
Howard was a very healthy man living under a whole different location.
And so, again, so then part of the whole scheme here is, though, is that somebody else had to have known this. Who else would have known that that wasn't, that the old guy with the bad breath wasn't the real Howard Hughes? Who else would have had to have been in on the deal?
What we have deduced on that is there Howard had Mormon aides. He really trusted the Mormon aides, and there was a group of Mormon aides that were working with the stand-in, the long-haired, long-fingernail guy, and Howard had several Mormon aides working with him. They could communicate back and forth because Howard controlled the CIA's communication satellites. So they could communicate back and forth. And then there was also a couple doctors who were providing drugs for this long-haired, long-fingernail guy because he was a drug addict. And they're providing drugs for him. So we think there's about 8 or 10 people that knew that Howard Hughes was not the long-haired, long-fingernail guy and knew the real story of it, but they all kept their mouth shut. And the aides were all paid to keep their mouth shut, of course.
Now, Howard Hughes was never Church of Latter-day Saints.
No. Howard really didn't have much religious
at all.
But he actions on anything, no.
But I remember this from other biographies, that for whatever reason, and I'm not saying this was ill-founded, he felt that people who were LDS were the most honest and most trustworthy.
That's correct. That's correct. I think they didn't smoke, they didn't drink. They were able to keep secrets. He trusted them very, very, he were very highly trusted people to Howard. That is
right.
That's correct.
Okay, explicitly trusted them. So some aides would have known this. That certainly then again feeds the narrative of why he left all of that money to the Church of Latter-day Saints. That
correct.
This, and as opposed to the other, you know, to dying intestate, where they had to have settled this in a court, and it's just very expensive to do it that way, which is ridiculous for anybody who knows the first thing about business. So, so that's the story, that he's got a couple of guys who are helping with this ruse, but otherwise it's a fairly tight circle. He's not being photographed. His girlfriend is essentially in Panama, and she knows him by a different name. He's not seeing Gene Peters anymore, and I'm assuming that they're just doing the divorce via correspondence. They don't have kids. They don't have to work out anything that way. So it's just a matter of working out the numbers between lawyers, right?
Correct. And that would finalize in 71, early 71, I think, is when that divorce of Gene Peters. So there's a period of time there he was married to two women under two different names, but he was married to two women.
Yeah, and in two different countries.
Yes, yes, exactly, yes.
Okay.
Very true.
All right, so the real Howard Hughes, under this name borrowed from a late CIA operative, we can assume, that guy and Eva McClellan are now setting off in a whole different sub-narrative from the Howard Hughes story. The main story is that this guy, the long-haired guy with the bad breath, the bad teeth, and the fingernails, and walking around with, you know, Kleenex boxes on his feet and all that stuff, that is real. It's not a myth. It's just not the real Howard. And it's some guy who's kind of incoherent, who's being manipulated, who's a drug addict, and they're giving him, you know, a pretty good life. He doesn't have to worry about anything. He's not on the street. And how do we think they met again? How did Howard meet that guy in the first place?
I don't know how that happened. I was just told that the man was an acquaintance of Howard, who was 20 years older than Howard, and Howard just provided him, drugs and food for the rest of his life. 1976 was the end of his natural life.
And we don't know anything about his biography, where he was from, whether he had another family, whether he left kids behind or anything like that.
Right. No, we don't know that. There's still a bunch of mystery setting in here.
Okay. That which may also be found in the shoeboxes of history in around somewhere when, you know, Aunt so-and-so passes on, and when they go into her bedroom closet, there are going to be more photographs and more documents that could inform the rest of this story. But until that happens, we're just piecing it together with Mark Music on the real secret life of Howard Hughes. So the real Howard Hughes marries Eva McClellan. We'll get back to that coming up in just a minute. Where do they go? What happens? And the Howard Hughes of lore, the hermit looking guy, that guy just continues to function as Howard Stern. I'm sorry, as Howard Stern, listen to me, as Howard Hughes, and they separate. And we'll get back to that then with Mark Music. I think this is just fascinating. I love stuff like this. Obviously there are some leaps here to be made, but I think when we continue with the story, at least retroactively, some of those gaps will get filled in next. On Coast to Coast AM, this is Ian Punnett.